August 18th meeting to order at 4:30 PM. Call to order. Welcome Brian Foley. He sends his regrets, but he's in Texas. And he didn't think, he could zoom in from there.
Now, he is the new town manager.
Talent.
Very familiar face, by the way.
He was on Channel 61 News for a number of years. Very familiar face. But also, he's a deputy chief in Hartford for communications and done with the state police doing administrative duties as well as communications. So, yeah.
Interesting change of occupation.
But has a lot of administrative experience through the state, too. So, so he did reply that he's looking forward to participating in the future. And so then we can move on to approval of minutes of June 16th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Deb Walsh. Is there a second?
Got to be somebody who was there.
I don't think I was there.
I don't think you were there.
I'll second it.
Thank you, Tammy.
You're
welcome.
So it's been.
Sorry, I'm having camera problems, just so you know. So.
That's fine.
We should see the chat just in case they're sending us messages.
Any amendments to the minutes? Hearing none. All in favor, please say aye.
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 The abstentions or
Heather's abstaining according to the chat.
Heather's abstaining.
Okay, so we have two abstentions. So the minutes are approved. Moving on. Old business, public comments. Anyone for public comment?
Do we get anything?
No, okay. We did
so
not.
So there's no public comment, old business none, new business. Item number one, per capita grant and aid funding application for state fiscal year 2023. Rob?
So you have in your meeting packet a cover memo and an application for the per capita grant and aid that every local, not every, but most local health departments and health districts in the state of Connecticut are eligible from the State Department of Public Health. This is their primary, as you may recall, source of funding support to local public health historically. This particular year represents level funding from the previous year at $2.60 per capita. Which is a total award of $206,499.80. This funding in this application and in pretty much all the applications in the past is funding at 1.8 FTE of our senior sanitarian position categories, specifically Holly Hood, 100% of her position, and then 80% of Glenn Bagdonian's position. You can see, if you're interested, the budget on page 4, but it's effectively their salary and benefits. And obviously it covers, in terms of activity goals, the services they provide, which everybody understands generally what those are in terms of environmental health services to our member towns. So I am asking for authorization to execute and submit the application as presented. It actually hasn't been submitted as of yet. And I'd be glad to answer any questions regarding the application at this time.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to authorize the execution and submittal of the Ethan Hounds Health District Fiscal Year 2022-2023 State of Connecticut Department of Public Health per capita funding application as presented on August 18th, 2022.
Second. Moved and seconded by Mark. Any discussion on
it? I'm sorry, the keyboard's not responding. I'm trying to. Heather? There is a link in the email that was sent sent out that brings you to the packet and all the meeting materials?
Mm-hmm. Well, she's got a thumbs up there.
Keyboard must need a battery.
Yeah. Better, I got something in the way of it.
I saw the agenda, and I thought everything was in that link. I didn't see the, in that attachment, I didn't see the link. So I'm sorry, I'm going to open that now.
Great. Do you want me to look at it, or? Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any abstentions or votes of negative? Hearing none? It's approved. Is that blue ink? All right, we can move on then. Next item of new business is Talend Employment Wellness Service Agreement ratification. It's been an ongoing standing project, so Rob, why don't you give us some background?
Sure. For probably over a decade now, on a contractual basis, our health district staff has been providing basic employee wellness services to the town of Talend. The scope of services are detailed within the copy of the contract you have in this packet, but it's effectively lunch and learn programs, health risk assessment, online health risk assessment, some quarterly newsletters, and some other consultations and tools as the employees need. We charge a flat fee of $7,350. This contract has been executed, so I'm looking for this board to ratify that agreement. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I have a question.
Sure.
Sorry. We never get any stats on this. How many people participate in this?
Well, it varies from year to year. Sure. The town of Talend has about 80, 85 staff persons. Mm-hmm. On the government side, not including the Board of Education. And we get anywhere from 10 to 15 participants a year in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I yield to Tammy on the motion here.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy, you want to make a motion?
I make the motion
to ratify
as presented.
Mm-hmm.
To ratify as presented?
Mm-hmm.
Ratify as presented, yes.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Deb Walsh. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any abstentions or votes to the contrary? Hearing none, motion's approved. Moving on to director's reports and
subcommittee
reports.
Town reports, actually.
Town reports. God. I'm trying to get this meeting over with.
He's jumping ahead of you.
Jumping way ahead. Town reports. Why don't we start with Mark, since he may have to step out.
Thank you, John. Right now, in the conference room right next to me, we're having a economic development, planning and zoning meeting to try to discuss how to look at our regs and make them a little easier to understand for those people wanting to do business in Columbia. And it's a challenge because they're written for planning and zoning needs, making sure we keep things in control, but they create a lot of confusion to those that are not used to reading planning and zoning regs. So I think that's the start of a much longer discussion here, and we'll see how this first meeting goes.
Is that
that's
it?
All
Who wants to go next? Susan?
Unmute myself here. Hi. Sorry I was late. Mismanaged my time. So for the town of Scotland, I have a few notes that Gary gave me. The new garage, there's a new garage for Public Works, and we had it built by members of the local Mennonite community. We used the proceeds as a fundraiser for their church. and the project was completed in less than a week. They were pretty fantastic. Looks great. And also, Scotland and Canterbury are working together on combining their ambulance services. The towns wanted the two fire departments to either merge their emergency medical services or create a single entity to provide service to both towns, but neither department wished to merge with the other, and state regulations do not allow for the easy transfer of a license to operate an ambulance service. Got very complicated PSA from the existing provider to the new one. So for now, we are only able to combine hiring, supervision, and payroll for the paid staff. By doing that and by spreading the costs across the two towns, we will be able to have a 24-hour coverage by paid staff in both towns. We're hoping this is the first step toward true regionalization of emergency medical service. And just a couple more points. Scotland and Hampton are in discussion to merge their grade schools, which currently have a combined student population of only 175, less than half of what it was in 2000. The plan calls for a single school to be operated by a committee made up of members of each town's board of education. The state is funding the cost of planning, legal fees, website, etc., with a direct grant of $25,000. And the last point is that the drought, which I know has affected so many people, drought conditions have resulted in at least one household in Scotland losing access to fresh water. The family has been given access to the showers and water supply at the firehouse. And that's it for me.
Thanks.
That's a real big issue, though. What, the water, the wells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Heather, you want to go?
Chief Mansfield.
Or Ryan, who's covering Mansfield?
I don't have any Mansfield updates. I think next time I will coordinate with Ryan.
Okay.
Updates.
Okay.
Continue to move forward with the completion of our new Mansfield Elementary School. We're consolidating three elementary schools down to one. Southeast School, which is the site of the new consolidated elementary school. Demolition is wrapping up on that building, so there's definitely no going back. We're not sending kids to that school next year. It's gone. And focus is pivoted into how to open or how to operate Vinton and Goodman schools for the foreseeable future, next academic year, since the construction of the new school is behind schedule. And it's not probably even looking like we're going to get into that building for the end of 2022. I think it's more of an early 2023 proposition. So. That creates all sorts of logistical challenges, given that we'll have elementary age kids. Oftentimes, you know, different families have different age kids, and so one is in my own family falls in this category, where my older daughter will go to Goodwin, and my son will go to Vinton, and then we have to figure out what after school looks like with two different schools. So. We're all eager to get the new school open, but I want to make sure it gets done right. It's going to be the first ever net zero, at least for new construction, first ever new net zero public school in the state of Connecticut. So we definitely want to get that achievement. And so that's all very exciting, just hopefully on a timeline that we've been elongated any more than our has. Otherwise, we are nearing the completion of phase one of our comprehensive municipal facility needs assessment that's been going on for about 10 months now, 10 and a half months now. The architecture firm we're working with has given us a number of different alternatives to examine, everything from renovation of existing buildings to construction of new facilities. And I'm happy to report that under all of the units, we're looking to continue to carry off the space for Eastern Highland South District. I know that in the past we've discussed potential capital contributions that we can make towards such a project if and when it happens, and we're certainly nowhere near pulling the trigger on a project now, but we are at least zeroing in on some initial cost estimates. If the town council likes what they hear, we'll be doing phase two, which is a much more in-depth schematic design phase with more precise cost estimates next year, applying the bond referendum probably in November of 24, although November of 23 is entirely out of the question.
September 8th is the deadline.
Is that?
September 8th is the deadline for the Secretary of State if you want it in November.
So that's that. Other than gearing up for college kids coming back, it's going to be a zoo here in the next handful of days.
My daughter's going to be one of them.
Yeah. Colin?
Is she moving up to campus? Look for her.
I don't have anything interesting to talk about right now. There's really nothing massive going on.
Okay. Bolton?
Well, the Board of Selectmen has expressed their interest in having me stay on in this role permanently.
Mm.
And we're working toward that. Probably will happen sometime September, October time frame.
Wow. Congratulations. Hope it works out.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you know, we've, like many other towns, we've had problems with short staffing this year. We're nearly fully staffed again. We've had some retirements, some illnesses, some people out for surgeries, and I think we're back up to fighting weight here pretty quickly. So that's going pretty well. I'm happy to report that we have not had the issues with Bolton Lake that we had last year. You know, I'm sorry that Coventry had an issue, but you know, normally it's Bolton that you're hearing about in the news with regard to the algae blooms. That it's really exciting. We've got 2 weeks left to go to our lake season, and it looks like we might make it without closing this year, which would be extraordinary. Beyond that, you know, I think that, you know, we're really doing pretty well. We're moving forward like everybody else. You know, we had grant deadlines to meet. I think we, you know, met all those deadlines, and we're looking forward to a good year.
Good. So I'll pick up on that for Coventry. Our lake was closed for 18 days. We told people...
It wasn't closed.
I'm sorry, it had a health alert.
Advisory.
Advisory. Now we're on a health alert.
You will die. Yeah. No, you sent them all to Columbia Lake, John.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we certainly did. Yeah,
so we had a very peaceful weekend at Patriots Park for a change. Lost a lot of money, but... The good news is the lake is still getting better. We're going to watch the thermocline change to see what impacts that may have when the bottom turns over, releases a lot of phosphorus. Our lake, frankly, has been a puzzle to Dr. Kortman, who doesn't get puzzled easily. We have very low phosphorus levels, which are not usually indicative of green algae bloom. Usually it's so all the people blaming fertilizers, we appreciate that people are aware of that, but that's not what caused this one. And we don't really know exactly what caused it. Dr. Kortman says he believes that it was an extraordinarily warm December last year. And the temperature didn't drop fast, and even when there was an ice cap, the water underneath was still warm. The ice actually can actually be an insulator too. So. The word climate change has been used, so that's that. You know, is a scary thought that it means that this was our first time ever that we know of, and it, whether we're into this pattern now. But usually, the cold water in December kind of stops the growth of the blue-green and stunts it back. But it was very active. We're going to change our testing protocols to start testing earlier. So we can get indications of the volume of it earlier in spring than we had started before. So I think we had a good program. Thank the health district for their assistance. And we were able to get it back open in time that the kids last week of our summer camp, the kids could go on the lake again if their parents allowed them.
Can I ask a question, John? Because I actually had a question from us. Somebody living on the lake directed at me to find out for her about this whole issue. She lives on the lake, and she said that they were able to walk across the lake last year because it was frozen enough so that people could actually walk across.
So it froze in January. Late January it froze. But
That did not have impact on blue algae, I take it?
It has to be cold in December. It has to...
The water temperature
December
has
to was really warm.
December, okay.
It was a really warm December, so the water temperature didn't get chilled. So yes, the lake froze last year, but
surface
it wasn't deep enough. Yeah. The cold had passed it to penetrate down deep, and it just didn't. So yes, it froze. People could snowmobile on the lake, but it was a short season for cold, mm-hmm. and that's not long enough. It has to be longer. It has to really
start early.
Has to start early and be sustained and get deep, mm-hmm. because the water, the cold water at the bottom, you have earth, which is warm. Mm-hmm. And spring water coming in, which is warm. Mm-hmm. We need to get cold down low. Mm-hmm. And it's a spring-fed lake, and that means that earth warm water is coming into the bottom. Mm-hmm. The top cap is it's an ice cap, and we need it to penetrate deep. So
that's helpful, thank you.
Dr. Gortman and the team of people testing was good. We're getting as much data out and trying to respond as fast as we can. Little interesting thing, I've been asked to serve on a panel for the International City Managers Association to talk about regional health districts at a webinar in October with two other panel members.
A national event?
National event. Mm-hmm. So I'll talk to you before that. Mm-hmm. We're getting some stuff together. Okay. But they want to use the Connecticut's model of regional health districts mm-hmm. to promote regionalism in health.
Great.
Why was I asked? ICMA actually sent me to overseas to DACA.
The result of that case study.
Promote this internationally. Mm-hmm. So I was on their list. So they flew me over there for a 4-day International Public Health Conference to talk about regional health districts.
You and not me?
I'm a member of ICMA, you're not.
You need to join.
It was interesting because in Pakistan they don't have local government. Hmm. So most of their health services are provided by non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and they were fascinated by, what a quasi-governmental health district can do mm-hmm. that's not an NGO. Because right. NGOs have their own philosophical, some can't do these types of things because mm-hmm. of religious reasons and so forth. So it was interesting. But that was an honor to do. I wanted to talk also that we're waiting for the Senate and House to reconcile their budget, but we have a placeholder for $1.4 million to do the Bolton sewer connection into Route 44. We've had initial discussions with Manchester. We need the Bolton and Burnham Sewer Authority to basically ask them with a signature from us that we're requesting it to amend the map. But they really want it to come with a contract agency. We don't have a contract with them, so they want to. But they're planning to hold a meeting in October at their board of directors to allow that map amendment. So Mike Roof, our sewer person, is working on that. So that will be about the time when hopefully the federal government's passes the budget. We'll know whether it's real or not. And then it'll take a while. But we also have money for sewers coming from the state of Connecticut to do a facilities plan, which will look at expansions to our plant and or running a lateral down the railroad tracks to the Willimantic plant, because our plant is in the high 90% of committed capacity. Mm-hmm. So we really can't add more things. I think we can add another 36 houses, and that's it.
Can I go back to the Bolton? Where does the sewage go?
Manchester,
okay. So, all three tons, Bolton, Vernon.
Yeah, yep. So we would just tie in. We extended a line to, while Bolton was doing it, we threw lines mm-hmm. to the town line because the state didn't want that, so we just threw it in while they were there. So it's not a big expansion. It goes up, it's like 22, 24 properties. That's it. Partly because DEP didn't want the Twin Hills neighborhood, even though they have septic failures. They didn't want them tied in, and I can't explain it to you. They insisted on individual house wells. They're all on a public water supply, so you take one water test and it would be the same for all houses. There are testing at each house. We tried to explain there's one water tank that serves all these houses, and they just couldn't understand that. And we didn't have time to fool around, so we, but there are, and we tried to point out that Twin Hills is polluting. It goes into the road and flows down into Bolton Lake. So, you know, we had to move on. We spent a year and a half trying to talk to them. We're building a new transfer station. Should be done by, at our next to our Public Works garage. Should be done by the middle of September. We're about halfway through construction. We're going to get into food recycling to some degree there locally, and are working with High Tone Farms, which has an anaerobic digester underway. It's under construction. It's huge. And they're going on to a phase two, which will add another generator. A lot of their power actually has been purchased by the city of New Britain that they're going to generate. But they're going to start providing, they want to get into going around and picking up food waste from restaurants, grocery stores, school cafeterias. So you'll be hearing more on a way to divert 30% of your waste, if you do a town-wide collection, to this locally sourced anaerobic digester. And if the cost is less than the cost of disposal at $85, $90 a ton, or up to $120, depending on your contract, you'd save money and do the right thing for the earth. So we'll be working on that. But a very ingenious woman engineer, Rashi out of Cambridge, Mass., is the designer of this, and that has one underway and two others, one operating and two others in design. So very exciting for our area, and they can do about a 50-mile radius of food collection of Route 44. So innovative stuff. Capital projects, we have a softball field, bid opening for next Monday. I put in a steep grant for a second softball field. We'll hear September 15th on that. And through the work of Council Chair Lisa Thomas, we got $500,000 from the State Bond Commission for ADA and equity issues at, and all three of these projects will be a major improvement to Miller Richardson Field. We also did methane venting at the old landfill at Miller Richardson Field and converted half of the football field to a full football field, so there's now two football fields, and added a recreational softball field at the same time. So that park is going to be something special in a couple of years. We squeezed in at the last minute, took 5.5 months for the State Department of Education to approve our roof replacement program. So late in April, we got the authorization to go out to bid. We gave it a shot that we could get something done, and we have now got really competitive roofs because it didn't rain and they had time and they had the materials in the warehouse. So we got two very competitive bids at $28 a square foot. The state thought it was going to be $52 a foot, and they were laughing at us that we only budgeted 30. So it actually came in under budget, which is the only bid we've had coming in under budget. But they're up in the high school roof and the Robertson School roof, and hopefully we'll get it done within 2 weeks before kids get there.
That's exciting.
It's exciting at the high school because that will allow us to then put on most of a 500 kilowatt solar system that it would have expired in April. So we had to get it operational by April, and they'll be up there in September and October installing solar at 7.63 cents a kilowatt for 20 years. So we're really excited about that. We'll should be able to be tied into the microgrid project, which is also available and will allow us to get rid of one of the four combined heat power plants, which will reduce the capital expense of the plant and our operational expense. Instead of buying natural gas, we're going more green. So really excited about that. On some not so good news, Channel 3 Country Camp is closed and going to go on the market for sale. They have offered it to the town. I've sent feelers out to other towns to see if they want to go on a regional thing, and Columbia said that Andover should buy it. Bolton said, yeah, maybe we should talk, but it's daunting. There's over 40 buildings there. Some of them are 3 years old. They went into a major capital spending spree, and there's no money. And COVID hurt them, and they made a decision about 2 days before they were supposed to open, and they had foreign students already coming for the summer, and they had to close. So we're meeting with them in early September to see if there's something to be do. They don't want a subdivision, but that's an impossibility. So it's just
Is that in Andover at all?
No, it's all in Coventry.
Totally in Coventry, okay.
They use an Andover address, which is not proper, but they're all in town. We actually have a road, dirt road, that goes through from South Street to them. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't want to. I drove through it with my car, made it, barely. But it would be really bad for subdivision. But anyway, sad news, and we'll see whether there's something can be done. So it's been not that with the lake. It's not been a quiet summer and all these projects. We also are going ahead with a $4.8 million road and bridge and culvert and payloader project for the November ballot, which we decided on last week, calling a town meeting for September 6th to meet the September 8th guideline to get on the November ballot. So we'll see. But this is a culmination of, we did a road software survey study, we're at a grade C, which is not horrible, in the 70s for pavement, but we want to try to get up into the B's. Doing full subdivision work in Connecticut Water for Pilgrim Hills. We're a whole water line replacement program. So, busy.
Don't forget Woke.
Woke? There is no restaurant Woke. It's a joke.
It really is a joke?
Yes.
It's not going to open?
It's really
it's
a joke.
Oh, that's too bad.
It's really an online. It's an online joke. Yeah.
Huh. Explain that to anybody who's listening. I am.
There was a post on Facebook community page.
Yeah.
Facebook community page is a fake post about a new restaurant which doesn't exist.
It was a dig at the liberalism of some people in town.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The fact that we don't have a breakfast place in this town doesn't make anybody wonder. Because there is a big sign, you know, on the building itself, mm-hmm. coming soon. On the building.
I don't think it's related, though. I think it's two separate issues.
You talk about burgers, fries, and pies?
No, it's the old Francesca's.
I don't think it's related.
It's a joke. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really amazing, because everybody in town is talking about it.
Well, it's a Facebook joke.
And that, no, I'm not talking about that part. We're talking about the sign.
I haven't seen a sign.
I haven't seen a sign.
Trust me, I checked today.
Does it say Woke on it?
Woke, yes, coming soon, breakfast and coffee. That's a quote.
Would Leo do something like that?
No, Leo doesn't have a sense of humor.
Yeah. Huh.
We don't know about it. I know there was a Facebook post a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
That, you know...
Check it out, guys.
Okay.
Well, Leo would have talked to us. Leo's...
I just saw him today. I should have asked him. He's done with me. Okay. Enough of Coventry.
All right. Moving on. Subcommittee reports, Finance Committee.
Did Columbia say something? Did Mark say?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Finance Committee, I'll provide a rundown. The Finance Committee had a special meeting just prior to this regular meeting in which they reviewed and accepted the financial reports for the period ending June 30th, 2022. A copy of those reports are in your packet under item 3. I'll just provide a quick overview. Looking at the center column of the front page of that report, you'll see that we had total revenues of $946,593, which is 108% of our budgeted revenues. Our fee for service revenues generally exceeded what we had anticipated. Moving on down to expenditures, our subtotal for total operating expenditures is $881,000. $436, which was 93.8% of what we budgeted. Spending was lower than budgeted, mostly because of some vacancies that we had during the year, and some additional backfilling of expenditure line items with some reimbursements from expenditures we had the previous year but got reimbursed to us during the current year. So that left us with an operating surplus of the year of $65,157 with a resulting fund balance as of June 30th of $675,309. And I don't know if there's any finance committee members that want to add anything to that.
No, I'm good.
We're good.
Unless there's any questions, there's no action needed at this time, but I'd be glad to answer any questions that any regular board members may have.
So the only other comment, there may be some amendments for the next board meeting, the finance review before the board meeting.
Correct.
Personnel committee, is Ryan doing this?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Just a few words. We're gearing up for the latest iteration of the executive director's performance review. Going to, in the nearest term here, review the survey instrument, the assessment instrument, and make sure no minor tweaks are needed. I don't suspect anything will really be needed. And then we'll be having Rob do his self-assessment. And during a little over 2 week period in early September, board members have the opportunity to complete the assessment, and then personnel committee will compile the results and basically report out on that through the process. So ultimately culminating in mid-late October, which is where basically the board will adopt the review and accurately proposed changes, if any, to Rob's compensation plan as a result of the performance review process. So stay tuned. That's what they say.
Thanks, Ryan. Any questions for personnel committee? All right, let's try not to let this timeline slip. It seems like a long ways away already, but it will chase up on us. Director's reports.
Sure. So, as everybody is aware by now, monkeypox has been in the news quite a bit. I'll have Dr. Dartix here, so I'll have him say a few words or answer any clinical questions that they may have. I think, Dr. Dartix, are you here? I saw you there a second ago.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good, good. Just wanted to make sure you were there, because I suspect there may be some questions that you'd be better suited to answer. But in terms of the health district, I did want to start off with a few numbers. The State Health Department just recently announced a data portal. It launched a data portal on their website, on their monkeypox page, which anybody can go in there and look at the latest surveillance data. As of August 16th, there were 69 cases, either confirmed or probable, within the state of Connecticut. Within our area, they're reporting out on case counts at the county level only. And within Tallinn County, which comprised most of our town, we have one case. I will tell you that one case is actually within the Eastern Highlands Health District. Our clinical staff has been involved in that case, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. Also on this website, you can see the demographic that split out of the positive cases, and also the epidemiological chart to see how many cases are reported. It also reports out the administration of vaccine for cases which are at risk. These are individuals who were exposed and are receiving post-exposure prophylaxis vaccination. And so far in the state of Connecticut, there's been 1,110 doses of that which have been administered. Also in your packet is basically some communication that the health districts or health departments got from the state of Connecticut Health Department on the roles and responsibilities of local public health. We've gotten a lot more information since this document came out in June. My staff, clinical staff, has been involved in a number of orientations and that the online orientations that the state health department's been holding to prepare our staff for managing cases, making referrals. But the high level overview of our roles and responsibilities involve reviewing the online surveillance platform every day to see if there's a case that has dropped within our jurisdiction. If there is, we're obligated to reach out and contact and conduct an interview of that case, and perform a risk assessment and effect contact tracing to identify individuals that may have been potentially exposed by this case, and then connect with those close contacts, reach out to them, connect with them, and monitor those close contacts for 21 days, which is effectively the incubation period for monkeypox, and then update the state confidential surveillance system with this information and data for those cases that we are managing. And so we're obviously doing some of that now with a case that we're currently managing. I can tell you that another big part of what we're doing is when cases are identified, the risk is assessed, whether it's intermediate or high, and then we have to make an active referral to a list of 15 providers which have been identified around the state, which can provide the post-exposure vaccinations. The nearest one in our area is Planned Parenthood in Willimantic. What's interesting about these referrals is we just simply can't refer the patient to the provider. We have to call the patient up, the provider up directly, and set up the appointment. We're like an intermediary. That's how the state health department wants to do it. It's kind of unusual, but that's what we're doing.
Rob, just
yep.
Let me interrupt. Does that include UConn students?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, our population includes UConn students. The only other thing I would add is that we do have one other case that resides outside of our jurisdiction, but there was a workplace setting in which there were some potential exposures, and so we've been working with that situation too. Dr. Dardick, is there anything you'd like to add to my overview?
Rob, I don't think there's anything else to add. I mean, you obviously you're in possession of all of the local information. Nationally and internationally, cases continue to rise. I think something like 13,000 cases in the U.S. as of this past week. So. You can see greater mobilization on both the state and the local regional level in terms of dealing with this. It's kind of a deja vu with what we were dealing with COVID nearly 3 years ago, where it started out as being, oh, it's nothing, it'll go away, and then bit by bit, it seemed like it was really something. So far, my understanding is that at least certainly within the U.S., but also in much of the Western world, not Africa itself, but in these newer cases. At the moment, predominantly men who are having sex with men seems to be the predominant target group for acquisition of the disease, but there's every reason to think that it may begin to spread out into the rest of the population, and we just have to be on the alert.
I am aware that at the state level that there's an active, effort to reach out and communicate with and leverage partnerships with the LGBTQ community to try to try to identify and administer the individuals who may be at risk. The state's getting additional vaccinations from HHS, vaccine from HHS, and so they're hoping to be proactive about getting this vaccine out to the appropriate at-risk populations.
Dr. Dardeck, are you still there?
I'll take your question, but let me just add this. One big difference between what we're dealing with now and how we were dealing with COVID at the very beginning is that we already have at least two very effective vaccines which can be used for both post-exposure as well as, if it's appropriate, pre-exposure, and diagnostic facilities dramatically more available than there were in the early days of COVID. So even right now, I can actually obtain possible samples from patients that I might see in my office and send them to commercial laboratories, Quest or LabCorp, as well as the state lab. They're all set up to do that testing. From a case-finding point of view and from a treatment point of view, we are, at least technically, way ahead of where we were in COVID, where it took, you know, however long, 6 months to 9 months before testing was somewhat widely available and over a year before the vaccines were available. Did somebody have a question?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah?
Yeah, I actually have two questions. One has to do with monkeypox and one has to do with the polio that I've noticed is springing up a little bit. But the first question about monkeypox is, I'm a little puzzled about the whole business with babies. And I know it's not predominant here in Connecticut, but I have heard of a couple of cases of very young children, let's say under the age of two, who are have monkeypox. I can't even imagine how they could possibly get it.
There are only five cases in the United States, two in California, two in New York, one somewhere else. So I don't, you know, I mean, if you're in a family with people who have monkeypox, it could be transmitted to a baby.
How would it be transmitted?
By skin to skin, touching, holding. That seems to be the mechanism of transmission. In other words, it's not a sexually transmitted disease, but it seems to be spread during intimate body-to-body contact, skin to skin, if you will.
I see.
And so if you're taking care of babies, there's a lot of skin-to-skin contact.
Okay, and about polio? What is...
So that's an entirely different story.
Absolutely.
First of all, the major issue with polio is now that it's been seen in a predominantly under-vaccinated population or set of populations. Here in Eastern Connecticut, our rate of vaccination is extraordinarily high, and the likelihood of seeing a case here at this point, we have to think, is exceedingly low. But in populations which are under vaccinated, polio can show up. It's a bit of a complex story, and I don't know how much time you want me to spend with it, but let me just say that it comes from the fact that there are two vaccines for polio, the injectable polio, which is what we have been using in the United States for maybe the last 20 years exclusively, which has a very, very high rate of protection. Polio virus is an intestinal virus. It actually lives in the intestinal tract, but it has the capacity to get into the nervous system, and when it does, it can produce paralysis. So when polio was widespread, the vast majority of cases were very mild. People might have a little diarrhea, they'd get over it. But there would be some occasional cases of paralytic polio. The injectable vaccine produces very, very good immunity, but it is possible for somebody who's been vaccinated with the injectable vaccine to contract the poliovirus in their intestinal system and pass it along through their feces even though they don't get sick from it. Now, there are many countries of the world which are still using the oral vaccine. The oral vaccine is a lot cheaper, and it's a lot easier to administer in a mass setting.
Sugar cubes.
The one issue with the oral vaccine is that there is a rare potential for the oral polio vaccine to mutate and become pathogenic, and that appears to be what's happened. Type 2, there are three types of poliovirus, types 1, 2, and 3, and the type 2 poliovirus in the live vaccine has occasionally mutated where it can become pathogenic. Now, if you have polio virus being excreted in feces, so this is a condition where fecal matter gets into the food chain, then in populations that are poorly vaccinated, you can start having cases of polio. The wastewater surveillance in New York City indicates that there is polio virus in circulation in the New York City sewage system, which means that there probably are a large number of people in New York City who have contracted this mutated virus. They're passing it in their feces, but they're not getting sick because New York City as a whole has a very, very high vaccination rate. But there is a community north of New York City in Rockland County, and this particular community, I think, is mostly Orthodox Jews, which has a very low vaccination rate, maybe 60% or lower. And the virus that's been identified in the one case of paralytic polio there matches genetically similar viruses which are found in England and in Israel. So the notion is that this virus may be passed internationally in some of these populations. As long as our vaccination rate remains high, the likelihood of disease, paralytic disease, is remarkably low. But we still have to work on those populations that have low vaccination rates and get them up to the 90%+ that's needed to get durable community protection.
Dr. Dart.
So that's polio 101.
Yes. While we have you, can you educate us on the Lyme's disease progress of a vaccine?
Right. So some of you may know, or maybe all of you know, that I'm the chair of the safety committee for this new Lyme vaccine, so I'm intimately involved with it. And so, you know, I can't speak publicly about that work. I can just tell you what you've seen in press releases, and that is that the French vaccine company Valneva has developed this vaccine. They've taken it through phase one and phase two trials, which show that it is very safe and it provides very high levels of immunity. They've now partnered with Pfizer, and Pfizer has now taken over the phase three trial. And the press releases you've seen in the last week or two are from Pfizer, in which they're generating public interest in this to gear up their studies so that they can enroll something like 6,000 to 10,000 people throughout New England and the Mid-Atlantic states. And
oh, you went on mute.
Oh, we lost
you're
you.
You're muted now. There you go.
Okay, am I back?
You're back.
Sorry. Stray fingers. So they partnered with Pfizer. They're trying to generate 6,000 to 10,000 subjects into a phase three trial. The phase three trial is the final trial that will prove whether it works or not. We don't yet know whether it works. We have every reason to think it will, but it requires a phase three trial to prove that. That's going to take place over the next 2 years. And again, it really drives home the difference between what I'll call standard vaccine development, which is a 5 to 10 year process, compared to what happened with the COVID vaccine, which was incredibly greenlighted over a less than a 1 year period. So the Lyme vaccine is undergoing, you know, the more traditional standard processes. So it's going to be a few years before we have detailed information on its efficacy and before it actually comes to market. Probably the soonest it could come to market, if all of the studies come out just right, you know, could be maybe 3 years from now.
So is there anything the health district should be doing to educate people about the opportunity to sign up to be in this trial, or should we stay out of
it? I don't know. Well, first of all, I am not involved in any of the trials because I'm in charge of the safety part of it. So, you know, there's sort of a wall between me and the trials. So we're not doing any trials out of my office. We're not doing any trials here in Mansfield. There are probably some sites in other parts of Connecticut. I know there are some other sites in New England, but no, I don't think there's anything the health district needs to be doing simply because it doesn't relate to any activity that's going on right here in Tolland and Linden County.
Okay. Anybody else have anything for Dr. Gardick while we have him? Thank you very much for educating us.
Great. Rob, do you want me to, is there stuff for me to say?
Just in case, yeah, we're going to talk about COVID here in just a second.
Okay, good, I'll stick around. That's great.
So to that end, you do have a copy of the updated COVID-19 activity report under item 6. I must admit we failed to actually attach the latest surveillance data report to that activity report, although we did send it out last Friday to everybody. I did want to know one thing in the weekly case count. We've been tracking this since the beginning of the pandemic. And for the past 11 weeks, our weekly case count has been ranging anywhere between 65 to 85 cases. And what's unusual about this kind of phase in the pandemic is that there's always been a trend kind of up or down, up or down. This is kind of the first period of time, extended period of time, where cases have kind of plateaued. Which I find interesting, which I'm sure are due to a number of factors related to immunity in the community, immunity in the population, perhaps some seasonal issues, changes in transmission because of various variants. But I was curious, Dr. Dardick, about your thoughts on why we're looking at what is essentially, you know, 11, 12 weeks of kind of these sustained, consistent counts.
Yeah, I don't think I have a good answer except to confirm what you're saying.
Yeah.
And as I think I've mentioned at other meetings of the board, our own internal experience at Mansfield Family Practice is that we're still getting tons of calls. I think this last week it has begun to taper a little bit, but certainly 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, we were getting many, many phone calls with people who tested positive at home and who were sick, and we were either deciding to treat them or not with the antiviral. I think this is a fair statement. None of our patients has been hospitalized with COVID, and we've certainly not had any deaths. Of course, hospitalizations and deaths would be picked up, Rob, in the statistics that you get.
Yep.
And share with us, and those levels have been low.
They have.
And stabilizing. But in terms of community prevalence of infection, I still think there's a lot out there. And even though I still wear my mask when I go shopping, and I try to wear my mask in most other public places, nobody else is. So, you know, we may just be now at kind of a stalemate where there's a consistent low level of transmission. We have effective treatments. We have a high degree of vaccination prevalence in the community, which means that when people get sick, although they can transmit it to others, they themselves don't get terribly sick. So the worst part of it is that, you know, if they're following the rules, they're isolated for at least 5 days before they get back out in the public again.
Well, I think it does, you know, this kind of persistent level is just an indication that, you know, there's still there's still quite a bit of virus out there circulating in the community to a certain degree. And it's I'm anticipating that we're going to see a few more cases pop up once the UConn population starts immigrating into the area.
And schools reopen.
Yeah. And school.
And what is interesting to me is that I have not, at least in the last, let's say, 4 months, I've not seen any reports of new variants.
Right.
You know, it seems like for the last 2 years, every few months there'll be a report of a new variant of concern or variant of interest. I've not seen anything recently about that. So, you know, it's conceivable that maybe what you see is what you get. And like the common cold, which again is a coronavirus, maybe we're just going to be seeing this sort of constant low level of disease. I just don't know, though. I mean, that's all supposition.
So,
can I ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
Tammy.
So I saw the CDC also just released new guidance on the whole thing for testing and that, and I want to make sure that the schools have that, and we're not going to go back into the quarantining kids for, you know, the 10 days. And unless I missed something, Dr. Dardick, are you in line with the CDC's recommendation that regardless of vaccination status, you only have to test if you have symptoms, there's no more quarantining or any of those things, like all the new things?
No 6 foot separating distance.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's where it's at. And I've pretty much cast my lot over these last 2 years with the CDC guidance, even when it has not been met with approval by the general public. I think this is probably as good as it's going to get, and I'm trusting their judgment on it. Although, as I'm sure most of you have seen, it was announced yesterday a massive reorganization at the CDC to sort of take account of the fact that they have had some internal issues in terms of digesting and reporting and acting on various public issues of public health concern, not just COVID, but monkeypox and others. So. I still trust them, and I'm still willing to follow their guidance.
So are we then, Rob, are we making sure that this is the guidance that's being given to schools, so we don't have any superintendents out there who are going to decide that kids who are exposed have to be pulled out of school or quarantined? You know, we want to make sure that the guidance that's out there is going to follow along with the CDC.
So the State Health Department issued, State Department of Education, and the Office of Early Childhood issued guidance at the beginning of August. And effectively that guidance is, under most circumstances, is not recommending quarantine. The updated guidance from the CDC that we're currently discussing does specifically say that quarantine is not recommended. There's a couple of points to clarify in that regard. The updated guidance from the State Health Department does identify circumstances under when community transmission aligns with or is identified as high under the COVID-19 community levels. Under those circumstances, then school districts can consider, and this is what the guidance says, can consider more aggressive preventive measures for transmission in the school, which may include contact tracing and quarantine. So that language is in there, and that language is also in the CDC guidance too. It's buried. It's not obvious. The obvious language is quarantine is not recommended, but then you go down into the language and there is permissive phraseology which says that if things are extreme, schools can consider contact tracing quarantine. Now, do I think that schools will do that? I don't know. You know, our recommendations at the health district are going to align with the CDC's recommendations and with the State Health Department's recommendation. Am I going to stand here right here and tell you there's no way quarantining and contact tracing is never going to happen? I can't say that. I mean, there could be extreme circumstances under which it would be worth considering. I would say in most cases, under most conditions, however, that we will not be recommending quarantining or contact tracing. I would also say that the current guidance from the State Health Department does very clearly have protocols and steps for isolating those who are, you know, positive or probable cases of COVID-19, and for protecting those around in the school community against those who are symptomatic with mild symptoms, the so-called test, mask, and go protocol. I don't know if you saw that in the latest guidance or not, but under that protocol, the State Health Department has made it clear that they want to promote in-person learning. That's where everybody wants the kids to be. It's a healthy place for them to be. So under the test, mask, and go protocol, if a child has minor symptoms, they can still go to school as long as they test negative and they wear a mask. And if they have minor symptoms, that's the recommendation. And so you'll see a lot of schools probably employing that recommendation to keep kids in school who are symptomatic with some other condition, not COVID, but still able to go to school and not fall back on their studies. So that guidance does exist. And my agency, in fact, we had an internal meeting just last week amongst our clinical staff to kind of go through and go into the weeds on the State Health Department guidance on this issue, so that we're in the best possible position we can be to provide guidance and consultation to our school systems going into this year. Because I can tell you, many of them are still nervous. Just like I said before, there's still virus circulating. We're anticipating an increase in the prevalence as the weather gets colder and kids start coming together. And so it's going to be, we're anticipating more cases coming. And the health district will be in a position to provide them consultation and support to the best of our ability.
Dr. Daugherty, can I ask you one follow-up question about boosters? I know that the Moderna has been approved and it'll be released soon, but what about Pfizer? And can you get a Moderna booster if you had Pfizer all the way?
So here's the answer I've been giving people. Pardon me. There is at least one report that I'm aware of that shows a very modest increase in the immune response if you cross over. That is, if you had Pfizer to begin with, you get a booster with Moderna, or if you had Moderna to begin with, get a booster with Pfizer. So it shows a slight increase in the immune response. It doesn't show any increase in protection against disease. So in general, what I've been saying to people is, if you have an opportunity to get the alternate vaccine, get it. But if you had Pfizer and the only place you can get a vaccine has Pfizer, get that, because I'd much rather you get a booster than, you know, run around looking for the other one because you want that as opposed to the other. Generally speaking, I think the answer is get whatever you can. If you want to cross over, you can. There's no disadvantage to it. There might be a very minimal increase in the immune response, but there's not been shown to be any substantive benefit in protection against disease.
As I understand it, though, the one that protects against the new variants is only Moderna. They don't even have the Pfizer yet. Is that true?
I don't think that's true.
We do have a booster produced by Pfizer that deals with the BA.5 and...
No, I don't think that's true.
Not in the United States.
Right now are the same boosters we've had all along.
No, there's no Moderna in the United States either.
It contains the same product that's in the standard vaccine.
Hmm. Oh, well, that's not very helpful, is it?
No, there's this whole, do you get boosted now, or do you wait till maybe October?
Right.
When the more precise for this variant vaccines projected.
Yeah, I think that's a mistaken argument to this degree. we don't yet know what variants are going to be around in October. Mm-hmm. And there could well be some new shifts that make the BA4 and BA5 less relevant. So mm-hmm. my notion is if somebody's eligible for the booster, they should just get it whenever it's available.
Okay.
Now, I've had people say, well, I'm taking a big trip, you know, I'm going abroad in October, so I thought I'd wait till the end of September to get boosted just before I leave. Well, that might make some sense. But as Rob has said and as I've said, there's still plenty of disease here locally. Although people are not dangerously ill, they still get sick. Mm-hmm. It's no fun to get sick.
So I'm going to kind of move on with my, finish up my COVID activity report just to reiterate. Health district is following the state guidance. We're not recommending quarantine or contact tracing. We will, however, pursuant to the guidance, be responding to clusters and outbreaks and support schools' efforts to combat against clusters and outbreaks. The other thing I wanted to point out under the activity, COVID activity report. Is that we did, and I said this to the Finance Committee earlier, we did finally get formally approved our budget for the ECL2 grant, which is $378,850, which goes through the end of May 2000, actually goes through November 2024. And that's going to be funding, as indicated in my earlier application to you many months ago, continued funding of the existing staff that's funded mostly clinical under our ELC1 grant. So we're happy to have that money in place. And then finally, I just wanted to point out we have been doing a number of pop-up clinics over the summer. At Coventry's Farmers Markets, the Bolton Summer Concert. We're going to be at Celebrate Pollen and Celebrate Mansfield and a few others. So we're still actively engaged in COVID-19 vaccination efforts here in the Health District. And that comprises my COVID-19 activity report.
Why don't you keep going?
Okay. NACHO, next on the agenda is an update for the board. I had the pleasure of attending the National Association of City County Health Officials annual conference in Atlanta during the week of July 19th. I put an outline, a bullet point memorandum together, just identifying the many of the learning sessions that I attended. It was interesting to come together as nationally as public health officials, having just come out of the peak of this national public health emergency. And you can certainly see many of the learning sessions had various common themes to them, things like protecting public health officials and stress, burnout, and retention. And also, interestingly, climate change was also an issue that had a number that was covered by a number of sessions, which was very topical given the blue-green algae issues that we currently have. I was able to procure some interesting information and get some tools that I'm going to be exploring for possible use here in the health district with regards to the algae. So it was a helpful and relevant conference, and I was thankful to be able to go. Staff vacancies next on the agenda. We did fill a public health nurse position. I may have reported out that already. But since then, we also filled a public health emergency response coordinator position. Used to be subcontracted, but that person resigned, and so we filled that position by hiring a regular position. Again, this is 100%. This position is funded 100% by the FEP grant. We were able to lure away the emergency preparedness coordinator from the city of Hartford, and now this person's working for us, which is we're very happy to have. And then finally, we did fill our field staff vacancy. It was a topic of discussion at the last board meeting. The board had authorized me to kind of expand the position for it to be more competitive. In the end, I was unable to attract and come to terms with the candidate in which I needed that extra authorization for. And so, alternatively, I made a decision and appointed a young man who in an entry-level position, who has quite a bit of initial training. He just enrolled in the Master of Public Health program at the University of Connecticut. He seems very passionate about public health. He clearly wants to start a career in public health. And so we're gonna help him with that. And at the same time, my sense is, as the short time I've known this gentleman, he's gonna be a good addition to our team. And he starts beginning of September. Also in your packet under item 9 is the regular activity report. Nothing in here I really wanna point out per se, but if you see any issues in there, questions, please, by all means, ask them. And then to kind of finish out my report here, I think it's appropriate for my office and me to note that just today the governor declared Windham County and New London County an extreme level drought extreme level 3 drought conditions. The rest of the state's under 2. We're obviously dealing with a lot of lack of precipitation. We do have wells, private wells, that are going dry within our jurisdiction. I don't have a number of how many well drilling permits we have, but we're certainly seeing some of that under these conditions, especially among dug wells. The health district's role in this is mostly just to support private property owners when they have these kinds of problems. Facilitate the new well drilling if needed. Recently, the State Health Department sent out a communication. They want to know when bulk haulers are being asked to deliver bulk water to refill or resupply a private well. It's interesting, we got this communication just today. They want to know when it's happening. My perspective on that is just to a certain degree, just money poured down a black hole,
a well hole,
because over time that water goes down in the water column and develops a kind of a level of equilibrium in the water table, and is a very temporary fix. And so, to me, it doesn't seem like it's money well spent.
And how do we know people just aren't filling up their swimming pools?
Yeah, well, I don't know about that either. So that completes the health director's report.
Okay. Communications you want to bring to our attention?
One item under communication, item 11, the status of the FDA food code regulations. You may recall I've mentioned this a couple of times. Mm-hmm. This is a big deal. The state is transitioning away from the current food safety regulations in the Connecticut Public Health Code to the federal FDA Food Code. It's a complete revamp of the standards used to inspect restaurants. All our staff has effectively gone through the training for this. This was scheduled to happen 2 years ago, but the pandemic put it on pause. In the end, my perspective is that these standards are more science-based, they're easier to defend, and they provide for more flexibility in terms of compliance and discretion by the inspector in the field, so they're not as draconian as the current public health code is. The downside is that it's going to be a lot of work to implement these. And we're really not sure on the timing, because they just started the reg review process. They just completed the 30-day comment period under the reg review. Now they're going to go to the Attorney General's office for legal review, and then the Legislative Review Committee for final approval before it goes to the Secretary of State for signature and publishing.
And that can be a year and a half.
And that can be another number of months. So
it could be a year and a half.
Another year and a half. So it's impossible. So it's going to be a lot of work. We just don't know when it's going to happen. And so it's really hard to plan for. So I just wanted to kind of update everybody on that.
Rob, do you expect that there will be, a significant learning curve for our food service establishments that are currently working under, and they're used to the inspections the way that they currently are?
Significant? I don't think so. I think, you know, part of our job will be to help him with that learning curve. Some of those provisions have already been enacted through some previous legislative change, so we're already partway there. The inherent nature of the inspections will not change. The standards will be different, but not significantly different. The scoring will be easier. You know, it's not numeric scoring anymore. It's kind of pass, fail, or compliance. So I'm anticipating, yes, there will be a learning curve, but we will be there to help them. I'm cautiously optimistic that while it's going to be a lot of work, you know, and there will be a transition period, in the end, I think it will be better for everybody.
Good. Thank you. So, Rob Frieden, for our next meeting, can you give us an update of the cosmetology process?
The request from the board at last meeting was to provide a report around December. Do you want me to do an interim update too?
No, December's fine. I just want to make it.
That's okay. Sure.
Okay. Yep. Sure. Yep. Absolutely.
Yes. So I think we're through communications. We're on to other business. Anybody have any other business?
Erica's not here right now, is she?
No.
No, she's taking some time off.
Interested in that whole business with the tearing down all the woodlands to build mega building.
All I know was in the.
You're
still here at 6?
We'll be out.
We're almost done.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Right back up.
We're just sit there. We're
you guys
like
are
almost
okay,
out of
okay.
We're almost done. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just I'm sorry.
All I know is what I saw in the media.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can tell you that they had a public meeting that lasted 5 or 6 hours, and it's been adjourned to a second meeting.
Okay. Which is fairly standard. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Thanks, Jim.
Anything else under other business?
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
You want us to go?
Second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
You don't know me? You don't know me?
I guess there is.
Thank you.
I guess there's me.
There is a 6. Sorry.
You staying out of trouble?
Not hardly.
I probably would hear about it if you weren't.
Yeah. Well, I've no recent trouble in Bolton anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever you want.
Can't say that's the case anywhere else.
Record.
How are you doing?
Good. Don't stop that. I need that recording.
You can leave it on there like that, John. We're not going to use Zoom for this. We're all I'll make sure it does whatever it's doing.
Yeah. It'll take a little while.
It's
converting the mini recording.
We don't use
it all
for this.
Yeah, we need that.